Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, and today our subject is kind of a bad one, not one really relishing covering, but it's something we wanted to cover because of the lack of coverage in the mainstream media. But it's this whole thing of the Journey to Center of the Earth artists at Meteor Studios not getting paid for doing their work. And Jeff Huser is joining me today to talk about this. And Jeff, you've actually been interested in stuff like this for a while. There's a lot of this kind of spreading through the internet, so your things like this, I guess.
Well, around the time when you and I were together in the VES festival, that article had come out not too long before that from Variety about the insane production schedules. And it really sparked a lot of interest and conversation at the VES thing amongst everybody we talked to. There was just, it constantly kept coming up. And I thought at that time we should really try to figure out a way to do an expanded, some coverage of that and just kind of talk about some of the issues involved. So I've actually been working on a series of podcasts, and then this came to my attention. So there was a thread over on the CG Society webpage that I was pointed to with a press release that Dave Rand put out, who's kind of leading the charge for these 100 artists who are owed back pay of $1 million from the final work on the movie. And so it kind of tied this all together into this whole, we're going to do a three-part series. I've recorded two of the parts, the first one with Dave Rand, which is what we're going to listen to today. The second one is with Steve Hewlett from the Animation Guild, a union that represents animators. And the third one is with a guy from the state of California. And obviously, I understand our listeners are from a wide audience, worldwide audience, but I had to start somewhere. So yeah. I decided, since I'm in California, let's get somebody from the state of California to actually talk about, I'm tired of hearing terms turned around that everybody sits in the same room going, is that right? Is that the way it's supposed to be? And how come I'm on one schedule and you're on a different schedule? And so I want to find out, my mission was, what's the laws? What's the rules? But in the course of chasing that down, this story came to our attention. And I'm actually quite surprised that this hasn't been a bigger story.
I can't believe that. I just, when doing research on it, I did a check over at Variety.com and Hollywood Reporter, and maybe I searched wrong, but Meteor Unpaid, Meteor Pay, didn't come up with anything. I mean, there seems to be just a dearth of, lack of coverage on this. It's pretty egregious, I think. I mean, the stuff, businesses go under a lot, and there are a lot of people hurt by that. But I'm frankly shocked by lack of coverage in this, and that's one reason that I think it's really good that we cover it.
Well, and you know, also what's really kind of evil about this, too, is this is the foreign workers who went to Canada to work on this show that are the ones that are unpaid. And that's just, you uproot your life to go work on a film and then to not get paid. It's just unbelievable. So, I don't want to get into the specifics because I'd rather people go to the CG Society forums and check out the thread.
Thread, yep. We'll have the press release and the quick takes or in the story on the FX Guide site that you'll be able to see on our homepage. So you can actually read the press release that Dave Rand set out. I mean, he talks about it in the podcast, but something he effectively had to do after kind of hitting roadblocks in some of the media outlets that were doing this. And I mean, again, it's amazing to me, a company that was founded by the Discovery Networks, owners of the Discovery Channel and their whatever hundreds of cable channels in various forms. And it's just like, there just seems to be a little issue with ethics, I think, in the industry. It's really disappointing to me.
Well, and I'm really proud of David for taking a stand and standing up and being vocal about this, because obviously there's 100 artists that have been affected by this, but he's the one who's really taken the shots and getting out there in public and just speaking what he knows. And you'll get in this podcast, I think you'll hear. I mean, he's the first one to point out, go see the movie. He's proud of the work. This is a dispute between the owners of the company and the workers they were supposed to pay. And the film, he's very proud of the work, and he's the first one to say that. And he says it in every interview I've talked to him. Every time I've talked to him, both on microphone and off, he's very clear to point that out. And in the press release, he's very clear to point that out. But anyway, I think that what I'm really think people will hear from David, and I hope we'll talk about it a little bit afterward, is just a passion for the business itself and kind of some fundamental flaws in the way that feature films are made in terms of visual effects. That this is a worst case scenario that we all want to not see. But, you start combining these things, the insane schedules and artists not getting paid on a show when it's finished. And, you start wondering how far away we are from people wanting to organize.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, this is, like I say, the worst case scenario. And it's just horrible. And especially the timing of this was around the holidays, when people were not getting paid, not receiving the money, and they still haven't received the money as of this recording, nor do they expect to at this point, I don't think. So anyway, anything we can do to publicize this and get the information out there, I just think it's real important for everybody to go over to CG Society, and we'll put a link. We've got a link in the story for that on FX Guide. There's been 10,000 reads and a lot of discussion about this, and I think that the more we can drumbeat and get people to be aware of what has happened and stop this from happening again, if possible, then I think we need to do that.
Yeah, exactly. The bully pulpit, as they say. If we have an outlet for that to get it out there, that's what we're doing. So why don't we go ahead and join that conversation that Jeff recently had with David Rand.
So Dave, thanks for joining us. Why don't you take us through how you got into the business and kind of let's get through history before we get into this.
All right, well... That's an interesting story. I was a broker with Oppenheimer. I went to art school as a kid, degree in fine arts. But back then, I graduated in 1981. There really wasn't a lot of paying jobs in the art world. So I went back and got another degree in pre-med and followed quite a long path back into the art world. I was a social worker. I owned a construction company. Learned a lot about business there. Moved to Los Angeles from Maine to work for the Sports Club LA. There I met the head partners of Oppenheimer, who made me a broker, one of the top firms in the world. I was a few years into that and enjoying it quite a bit, making good money. And I came into my office one day and my assistant had a prospectus on my table, and below it was another one. One was for Alias and one was for Wavefront. We were going to be involved in some investment banking where they would do a secondary offering that would basically allow Silicon Graphics to take them over and eventually form what we use, today. When I opened the beauty page of the prospectus, there was pictures of Wireframe and the process involved in creating Jim Carrey's character in The Mask, and I was just blown away. And seeing it in front of me like that, it basically was in the back of my mind for quite a few days. I began gathering some clients in the area. At the time, Larry Fishburne was my next door neighbor in Venice, and he told me there was a place called the Post Group where they did that stuff. So that's where I met Mark Franco, and he looked at some of my artwork from way back, and I stayed a broker for quite some time, and then I decided to leave that career, took some time off, went to Belize, where I have a place, and when I came back, it was time to work again, and I called up my former clients, who fortunately I had made money for during the information superhighway explosion. So they said, sure, come by the studio and, check it out, see if you like it. And there was a great young artist at the time, he's now quite high up, who... let me use his workstation, and he put down a stack of tutorials, and he goes, here you go, man, this is how you log in, and this is how you open Alias, what was then called Power Animator. And 31 nights in a row, I went there and used that workstation, all the available moments, and then they gave me a shot, and that shot got finaled on version 1, which has never happened since, but it was quite exciting, and I'll never forget the conversation where the client asked if I could do these other versions, and I was exhausted, and I put everything I had into that, and I said, well, I probably just need to sleep a little, and then I'll get back to it. And the client said, well, drink some coffee, you know, do what it takes. This is show business, and you know, we need this tonight. And then another artist blurted out, he doesn't even work here. He's Peter's stockbroker. So that got a laugh. And then the next thing I know, I was being handed my first paycheck in the art world, which was very small compared to a broker's paycheck, but sure meant a lot to me. And that's how it started. And a lot of those people I'm very thankful and grateful for, especially Mark Franco.
That's great. So what? Tell us about some of the films you've worked on, mostly motion pictures.
Some of the big films, I think the first one my name's in is Flubber, and then Mr. Magoo, and let's see, Batman and Robin, and The Patriot, Eight-Legged Freaks, What Women Want, Monkey Bone, Scorpion King, The Matrix, Chronicles of Riddick, and recently Journey 3D, various music videos, of course, television stuff, commercials, and currently I work for an A-list producer who I hope to be with forever. The guy's amazing.
Excellent. Well, I came to see to know you because I've been working on a series of podcasts about labor laws, and came across your posting on CG Society, which I checked this morning, and it was over 10,000 views on that thread right now. Obviously, a very hot topic. Tell me how you ended up in Canada and what you were working on.
I had done some work for Meteor Studios on the show Slither and Fantastic Four. I enjoyed working for them. I thought that the studio had a great pipeline, a lot of great artists. I had worked in L.A. for them and never had worked directly in the studio in the beginning, but then I was offered a position to be the lead effects artist on Journey 3D. I had done a stereoscopic show way back, the Siegfried and Roy Magic Box back at Rainmaker, and really enjoyed seeing, you know, any artist would, seeing their work in that format. So I went up to Montreal, and the show was going well. A lot of great artists, and the city's just amazing. I mean, the Canadian artists are so talented, and I know there's the government kickback and all the other reasons to go there, but they sure do have a talent pool up there.
Is it difficult for Americans to work in Canada?
No, not really. There's a work permit, which they pretty much would give to us because we are specialized. Other than that, you know, I just drove up, crossed the border, showed my permit, got there. Meteor H&R took care of everything else. So it was pretty easy to get there and to get working.
So then, obviously, things went terribly wrong at some point for the...
Well, I began to see what was taking just a long, long time. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of shops make, and it's a habit that's just throughout the industry, is not really getting the client as involved as I would like to see them, you know, in the planning stages. We essentially are somewhat of a construction company, especially the bidding process. So unfortunately, there's no blueprint, so there's so much gray area. So, you know, certain set prices are put on shots, and then there can be overages and back and forth. But we began a process where the client really wasn't seeing anything until it was pretty much good enough to be in the movie. And there were changes made that, you know, I was not involved with the money and the figuring. But I could sure tell, just coming from the business world, that things couldn't be turning too profitable at this point. I'd heard the studio had trouble on the film 300 and gone into the red there. But what kept me going, and I think all the artists going, was that one of our owners, Discovery Communications, was a pretty deep pockets owner. So, you know, everyone just kept working. I was as vocal as I could be in production meetings, you know, in a positive way about ideas to probably get things, you know, finaled a little bit, you know, in a smarter fashion than what we were doing. I wasn't seeing a whole lot of client feedback at levels where they really should be involved. You know, it's It's important for that. I mean, you wouldn't direct your actors on the stage from a cell phone with a bad connection. And that's somewhat how we work. And it's just widespread in the industry. I don't point fingers at anybody. It's like we tend to do what the industry does, what's been done, and it's just proving itself to be completely inefficient and a recipe for bankruptcy.
Right. I mean, one of the things I've heard talking to people is the old don't make money on this job, don't make money on this job, and it's constantly chasing the money from the next job. Mm-hmm. And eventually that comes home to roost. I'm taking it that's what happened here, or maybe not that exact scenario, but eventually artists stop getting paid. Is that the gist?
Yeah, it's the third house I've been at. There's, you know, good sized ones too that have fallen apart for basically the same reason. They're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Let's get it in here. We'll figure it out when we do. I don't know of a construction company in the world that would build anything without a blueprint. And when I had a construction business, it wasn't, you know, something gigantic, but we were very successful because when I came to a client that didn't have a design, you know, we did big outdoor projects, stone walls, brick driveways, decks, retaining walls, lawns, whatever. If I went to a wealthy homeowner who just wanted to be creative, but they didn't really have a landscape architect and didn't really want to pay for that. They wanted to be that. They just kind of wanted to make their property like a palette, you know, and kind of have the creative process. We would do stuff on a cost-plus basis. So much a man hour. I won't mark up the materials. I might charge a delivery charge, and let's have a lot of fun. Those projects went extremely well. Gets everybody to the point, you know. And I know in production, it's pretty much the way it's done. People are paid for their time. But for some reason in the effects world, it's, I don't know, this business model that's just inefficient, almost laughable to the rest of the business world. You know, I learned when I was a broker, you know, a lot of great lessons. And one was, you know, right from my managers, you know, you got to call for the big clients because the closer you are to the big piles of money, the more money you make and the more money the firm makes. Well, there's no shortage of funds in Hollywood for big productions. And this, you know, the three houses that I've been at that have fallen were certainly doing big budget films. Why we can't get a piece of that is just kind of a mystery to me. Not so much in how to do it, but why it's done the way it's done. I don't understand that.
Well, I think at one of the VES meetings, somebody made the comment that, you know, the visual effects is now, you know, look at the top movies of the year. They're almost always visual effects movies.
Batman.
We cross, Batman, $155 million this past weekend.
Yeah.
We cross all disciplines. We're involved with wardrobe. We're involved with lighting. We're involved with, you know, set design. We're involved with production design. We're involved with everything about the movie. In some cases, we're actually now creating digital actors.
Yeah.
That are, you know, would be cast just like any other actor and is responsible for the movie as much as any actor. But yet, the respect and the respect of the craft and the respect of the people is actually much less. And so I think I understand. I that hit me when I just the size of what we contribute versus where we appear, you know, in the credits, for example.
Definitely. I mean, I've said this in several posts online and the press release to the different reporters that I've been talking to. We're as important to the product as just the rest of the talent is. We are just going through a lot of the growing pains that most of the talent did decades ago. We're relatively nascent on the whole timeline of entertainment. And it's a natural course of events. I mean, new industries are often exploited until they finally unionize or laws come in place to protect them. So I would really like to see some type of union form. I know at this stage of the game, it's global, it's worldwide. I mean, we've got China, India, we got Czechoslovakia, I mean, Ukraine. I mean, it's wonderful that there's a day and age now where an artist, you know, and I tell lots of kids coming out of school, you can make money now. It's not like back in 1981 when I graduated in fine arts. I mean, there's actually a way for you, almost in the first time in the history of man, to make a career, and in some countries, you know, as much as some of their doctors make, and to really get rewarded and be able to use what you're best at to support yourself and your family rather than doing something else like I did for years, you know, always doing it on the side, drawing a friend's father, you know, for a gift, trying to do paintings here and there. But, you know, you get all your energy has to go towards something, and what you do for a living is where it all goes. So it's just great that these days we can actually make money.
Right. Now, you don't, in your post, you've been very clear to say, go see the movie.
Yes.
You're very proud of the work.
Yes.
And that the problem's not with the movie. The problem is
not
with
at all.
The company. And now, I also understand that the director was is a former visual effects supervisor,
yes,
from ILM, right?
Yep.
Eric Brevig?
Yes.
You know.
Well, I got to meet Eric, and I really liked him. And just to start off, I mean, I know none of us have a problem at all with Walden Media or Brendan Fraser or the movie or Eric or any of the people on that end. I mean, it is a wonderful, groundbreaking film. It's the first time that digital sets have been incorporated with live action, and it's quite a trick to make that happen. And we pulled it off, I feel. All the houses did. So yeah, I highly recommend people see the film. I've read various reviews. It probably didn't get quite, the money it wanted to, but I think the thing has legs. And I really do feel that there's the future is there, and they are a milestone, and they deserve awards, technically especially. I met with Eric the one time he came up to the shop during production. I was doing the big waterfall sequence where the characters splash down as they reach the center of the earth. And the calculation involved in the software I'm using, RealFlow, is enormous. And to make changes in direction and size and speed and all in those waterfalls would be very time-consuming. Not so much for me, but the waiting period, to get your simulation. So I asked the visual effects person on our end if I could sit in on, one of these meetings with him. And I literally waited for 2 days for them to pull the shot up. And not to step on any toes, I had gotten permission to speak to him directly, which is the way I think it should be anyway. And the shot looped. We almost broke for the meeting, and I raised my hand and said, "Could we please look at the falls?" And I just prefaced with him, who I was, and said, "This is how I'm doing this, and it's quite a lot of time. If you want to change anything, this would be the time to say." So I let the shot loop. I let Eric just look at it. I kept my mouth shut, which is important. And he started making a few comments. Generally, really liked it. He even thought some of it was real water that we had shot, which was a compliment, as much to me as to the RealFlow people, Next Limit people. It's amazing software. Mm-hmm. And so he listed about 4 or 5 things that were really small changes on my end. And so not so much as to close the deal or not, but it's just a term I know from business. I said, "So if I do these 5 things, you'll final the shot." And he said, "Yes, I will." So I did those 5 things, and the next time he saw it, he finaled the shot. I think it was the 3rd shot we finaled out of all the ones we had. And I'd wished, that we were handling most of them that way, with that kind of feedback, because it did make a big difference, getting that one out of the way, so that we could take the 1.5 terabytes offline that I had to take up to create it. So...
sure.
Yeah.
Well, people, just from my own personal experience, I understand that frustration, though, about that is an unusual situation. Mm. We often finish our shots. We send them off across town to a screen. And this has not changed. I mean, when I moved out to L.A. 14, 15 years ago, one of my frustrations and reasons I went back toward commercials was I missed that direct interaction with clients. Mm-hmm. And I still see the same thing. You send stuff off across town, even if you have a really excellent in-house approval process, it still goes across to a screening room that you're not involved with, and somebody right. takes notes, and you get notes back through 3 people, right. and it is a really stifling way to work, I find. It's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. And it wastes a lot of money. As I said, the rest of the business world, I really believe, would laugh at if they really dissected how we operate. Being so close to large budgets and not being able to come up with a logical plan of both how to construct the shots that you need to accomplish with plenty of creative input, but to communicate with the client. It's so important in the beginning, that in the bidding process even, because it's not just being the lowest bidder. I refuse to think that we're so competitive now that if you aren't the low ball bidder, you won't get the movie. I think people are reasonable enough in the business world and in our entertainment world, especially in effects, that they know the difference between a Porsche and a Hyundai, you know, and what they want in their movie. So if you come to them and present them with a plan, this is how we work. This is the best way for both you and I to have a great relationship, get the most out of our artists, because believe me, when you're on version 200, you pretty much just want to die. And to avoid that, we need to create like a blueprint, something that you and I agree on, and then we build upon that. And if there has to be changes because of the creative process to that blueprint, that's really the only time that we'll charge you more than what we're bidding on, or even better yet, if we do the whole thing on a cost-plus basis with certain caps that get both you and I to the point, your product will reflect that, and you will get more creative juice from these minds, because bottom line is, any house you walk into, the most valuable software that you have are the minds of the artists, period. I mean, you can have the 64-pack of Crayola crayons, or you can have the 8-pack. But a true artist can make something wonderful with three colors even. So keeping that software tapped to its fullest should be a goal of every studio. And keeping them moving forward, getting feedback. We pretty much, as professional artists, have to learn how to kind of, not squash isn't the word, but contain our egos and realize that our ideas aren't necessarily wrong, that it's really just a matter of taste. And that taste is usually one person, and it's usually the director. If you can get that person's mind guiding all those other minds in a very communicative way, lots of feedback, never negativity and, you know, words like this is absolutely horrible, you know. You got to really get at the part of those minds that you want, because it is the most valuable software.
And can save you money.
Tremendous amounts of money. I mean, I can cite examples from when I worked in the bidding process, and I've worked extensively in the cost plus process, and the difference is astounding across all the areas that I just discussed.
Yeah. So you've poked your head up for this group of artists who have not been paid still.
Yes.
Which is very bold and brave of you, and I'm sure appreciated. Have you seen any progress at all or any communication from anybody about this?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I stood up for many reasons. I think there's quite a few that came to mind. Being in this business for 15 years, you tend to accumulate a little frustration. You know, it's almost like the kid in the crowd when the emperor's not wearing any clothes. You know, you just can't keep seeing that for too long without screaming out like the kid does in that fairy tale. I come from different worlds. I think a lot of people in entertainment were born and bred right into it, starting as production assistants and working their way up to directors, which is all fine and good, but I've been exposed to other things. So I'm sorry, I lost track.
No, just, you know, what made you come forward? What made
you've kind of been the spokesperson for this group,
and I'm just trying to...
Well, this is interesting because, you know, I'd worked off-site for the company Meteor in L.A., and when I went there, I sensed a dislike. I think... for a couple reasons. I'm American. Americans aren't the most popular people in the world anymore. They probably realized I got paid more than some one of my counterparts that are up there, because the Montreal artist, the wage scale is a little different, and things aren't any cheaper up there, believe me. Same prices as LA for everything. So there was a little bit of animosity. So to break through that, I just, as myself, I'm pretty good with people skills, and I'm definitely good at getting the most out of an artist. So once that barrier was down, I made many, many friends, and you know, I've been recommended by quite a few of them on the various networking sites like LinkedIn, and I pride myself on that as a supervisor, that I get the most out of that creative side, you know, of what those guys and gals are making. So to become that at that level, you definitely develop friendships and camaraderie, you know, artistic and creative friendships, which are strong bonds. And in realizing most of them, you know, had families. Like, there were two children or babies born from our staff during the production, and those dads came back to work pretty quick, you know, and went right back to it. And most of them have families. You know, you realize that when the cleaning crew knows you by name, and when they first walk in and you're there, they say, like they said to me, you must be American. And not that the Canadian artists don't like to work. They have families, you know, so they go home as they should. I mean, we should have lives. So I don't have a family, you know, single. I'm 48 years old. And when I left Montreal, and it just was running through my head that, you know, we had emails that, you know, waiting another week, and then those emails stopped about the pay that was due. Christmas was around the corner, and I kept thinking of all the friends I made and how, you know, not only did they not get paid, but they're not going to have money for Christmas, and they worked so hard. I'm talking 100-hour weeks, just like, in at the end, having to just stay away from their families. They brought up an American producer who had originally bid the show, and he was just driving everybody, you know, to finish because his reputation was much at stake. You know, to not deliver a show would have been catastrophic to the owners. I mean, the lawyers that the studios can get are much more powerful than a band of artists can, you know, get, you know, when the show ends and we all disperse to different parts of the globe, because about 30% of the artists were freelance, but they were on site full time, you know, same as the regular employees, paying taxes. You know, we invoiced instead of a time card, but we still filled out the time card, so the line was pretty gray there. So I did get vocal. I've been robbed in the past at gunpoint in my own home, and, you know, had to be involved with chasing those guys down. And I think some of those same feelings came to me, even though it's more white collar, still the feeling of being robbed, and almost like one of our artists had said in the first article that came out in La Presse, we were held hostage, saying we wouldn't get paid if we didn't deliver, so you better come to work. I just felt like I was, you know, felt almost like we were living in the times of like The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, about the meatpacking industry. I mean, laborers were treated similar, and it was only because of that book that the whole world changed. And, you know, they make you take certain courses in high school and college, and you wonder, why do I have to take this? And they want you to have a diversified education. But that book came to mind quite a bit, The Jungle, and how if no one had written about it, it never would have changed. So, yeah, I decided to become vocal. A lot of friends were like, you know, you better keep it quiet. You're going to hurt Montreal. You're going to be blacklisted. And it just, nothing set right. You know, I'm a spiritual person. I prayed on it a lot for guidance, to be clear, to not have self motives, to think about the group, guide my thinking. And I'm going with that because I feel good about this. I mean, it's better than sitting there stewing about it. I completely understand the artists that have chosen to remain silent, for whatever reason, I can completely respect that. But more and more are coming forward. The article that'll be in Playback Magazine tomorrow, the cover article, you'll see quite a few quotes from people that formerly were being, you know, fairly quiet. And I think you'll see more. My opinion on the whole blacklisting thing is you're watching too many movies. I think that in these times, especially in America, there still is a freedom of speech. And if you're speaking truthfully to the best of your knowledge and just, and not just finger pointing and shouting names, you're doing the right thing. So that's why I've become vocal.
I mean, you have also, from what it said in your post, you've tried contacting the Canadian authorities about this.
Yes.
You've tried, basically, it sounds like you've exhausted every recourse.
Yeah, someone told me who's quite close to me, and I'm not going to say his name, but he's a very famous actor, Academy Award winning actor, and he just said, Dave, you do the legwork, the rest is up to God, you know? So I do the legwork, and I put it out there. Because the rest really is up to powers that are, you know, higher than me and out of my control. So I'll continue to do what I can and try to do the legwork. And that meant, in the very beginning, talking to, of course, Meteor, and trying to contact Discovery. Even calling Brendan Fraser's manager at one point to simply say, I would really like to just have a chat with them, or if you could get them this message. There's over 100 effects artists that weren't paid. Now, I don't expect Brandon to write a check, but he is executive producer on the show, and he is part of the show, and he tends, you know, he will make considerable money from it if it is profitable, and pretty much all movies like that, eventually you get your dimes back. All I'd ask is that he make a few phone calls, you know, not publicly, just privately, however he wants to do it. And if he has any questions, he can email me or give me a call. And I don't know if they ever told him that. I did get an email from our producer who heard from Walden Media, who heard from apparently the manager's office. So that's okay, you know, so that, you know, I went on record as trying to talk to the higher ups. Couldn't get anyone to talk to me at Discovery or Evergreen. You know, the Meteor management was pretty much hush, you know, at that point. Their lawyers probably tell them to be that way, so I understand.
But now they're gone, right? They're gone. I understand there's another company, though, that's basically in the same space, same computers.
Yeah, and I'd like to start off by saying, you know, I have some friends that are working for the new company, Lumiere. And I really do wish them the best. But what is curious, and the reason why it can have a negative impact on our getting paid or just, you know, stopping this kind of behavior with large companies pulling this crap. This is out of the 30s and 40s. You know, we're not supposed to be that way anymore. The studio had been in talks during JCE's production, and this comes from people who would know that have been talking to me quite a bit lately, with a couple other potential buyers. Some of the buyers were offering a price that would cover quite a bit of their debt, you know, our wages, whatnot. But at some point, the decision was made to go with one of the buyers, but only if the studio was bankrupted, thereby being able to regain it for pennies on the dollar. One of the owners, Evergreen Films, had a production, it's a TV series that was on the table. And of course, being able to keep the same pipeline, key artists, you know, workstations, location, and somewhat the legacy of what Meteor Studios had worked on before, and being able to buy that up for pennies on the dollar after a bankruptcy could be quite attractive compared to actually paying the back wages and the other debts that they had to the community and the banks. So at some point, a decision was made whether it's legal or not. For me, that means little compared to whether it's ethical or even moral. I know it's a cutthroat business world, but it's not smart business. You know, maybe you save $2 million, but you're going to lose $20 million because of it. Because, you know, the real court out there is the court of public opinion. And thank God for the internet, because we're all able to communicate so quickly now. So it's not really a smart plan of action. And I was able to talk to, you know, one of the partners that's been involved with Meteor and the new studio, and I pretty much spelled it out like I said, and not in a mean way, but my advice would be to, you know, pick up the phone and call the old owners, call the new, say, let's work something out to at least pay the employees, because this is just, it's not right for one, and it's not smart business for the other. And apparently that never happened. So only after that did I begin to really go to the press. I mean, I'd written some letters, emails before to especially one writer, who I really won't mention because he's asked not to be, but for a very prominent magazine, you know, out of Los Angeles, who really wouldn't even make any phone calls on our behalf. The phone calls alone would have shooken up, you know, a few of the powers that be to maybe, you know, let's cut a check for these guys. This could get out of control. Wouldn't do that, and had written in this area quite extensively. And it just, you know, I spent so much time trying to feed him information. At one point, he was pretty much asking me to do his job, so I jokingly said, well, if you could come up here and work on these shots, I can make all these calls for you. But, right. So I realized I was kind of barking up the wrong tree. I mean, he was the one I wanted. But I went forward to some of the competitors, and then at one point someone said to me, you know, you can do a press release yourself. Well, I just didn't really, never done that before. And yeah, I was able to do that through this great service. I mean, if you just Google Meteor employees, you'll see it there. And eWorldWire were so helpful to me. And, you know, somewhat affordable. I had to put up some of my own money because I wanted it out there. I've been getting PayPal emails from PayPal about these artists that are, you know, sending me money, and, you know, they're paying more than they should. But whatever, I'm not here to make any money on this, that's for sure. So the press release went out, and I thought, all right, I should be getting a whole lot of phone calls tomorrow because the movie was coming out too. And in the release, I once again said, buy a ticket to this movie. This is an amazing movie. This is not against those people. And in a way, you know, I have to ride the film's release because it's of interest.
Sure.
You know, I know enough about media and stuff to get people's attention. So I don't think we're making a dent in the box office by any means. But yeah, I did start. There was a lag, and then I was almost ready to say, well, I've done everything I can do. There's really nothing else I can do, you know? So maybe I'll just go see the movie and forget about it. And then my phone started ringing. And then more, and then more, and then emails, lots of emails from artists all over the world sharing stories with me. And then, you know, I started the CG Talk string and some other ones. And now I get, you know, email makes that little pop when you it's popping like popcorn at night. And I've had such a great time just sharing stories. You can almost call it like AA, like Animators Anonymous. You know, it makes you feel a whole lot better that, you know, you're not alone. And this is the general feeling worldwide. And, yeah, there's plenty of effects artists. I mean, from Ukraine to China to, I mean, the broken English I'm getting, and then some of it's in their language, so I drop it into, like, various translate programs online. And it's just been kind of heartwarming. And I think that there is a time coming that that we will get a little more organized. And it is a great time to be an artist. I mean, started off cave painting, and, you know, I just, there's quotes from Michelangelo about how he was treated during the painting of the Sistine ceiling, and all that's still so identifiable, you know, but it is changing.
So let's just, to wrap this up, if you could speak directly to, I mean, our audience is, you know, tens of thousands of artists, 2D, 3D artists around the world, really. What could you say to them to caution them or to inspire them or to, you know, what's the best advice you can give them?
Be vocal about how you feel. Remembering that this is a really advantageous time to be an artist in the history of man. Talk to your friends about it. I mean, the internet is a powerful tool. And even though it may be difficult for us to form a, you know, a union like as strong as Screen Actors Guild or something, it isn't impossible. Because of the internet, we can kind of, you know, bond together. I've been putting together a plan where we could launch a website, nonprofit, where artists would be verified both by a small charge, like a couple dollars, to a Visa card with your name on it, and a relating it to the IMDb page, you know, so that we can see that it's you indeed, and any other ideas some people would have, I'd love to hear them. So verified artists in a private forum where we can rate the companies we work for. I was thinking of a percentile scale that's weighted, of course, the first question being, are you always paid on time, which is very important. What type of business plans do they incorporate? Are you happy with the way your company does business? Do you find that you're getting feedback from the decision maker? Is your work environment quiet and creative? Are your supervisors nurturing and getting the most out of you? Do you really love going to work? And do you really love the shows you're on? I mean, those kind of questions could be put into a fairly simple formula, much like they do stocks and companies and research, a percentile scale that's weighted. Thereby, we get some leverage there, because I am completely convinced that the demand for content is far outpacing the limited gene pool of true talent. We need to take that and bring that to our advantage. You know, I never been at a shop where the HR people are getting the people they want. They are sending emails, looking at reels. I look at them all the time. The true artists aren't really growing in numbers related to the rest of the population as fast as the demand for quality content. So keeping all that in mind, we need to express ourselves, both artistically and our business sense.
That's great. You know, I would add to that that, you know, you made a very good point in there about loving going to work, because that certainly has been my, you know, I've always considered that to be one of my big things is, you know, I love what I do. Mm-hmm. And I would add to listen to the people around you in your lives, because, you know, when your wife is saying, what are you doing? You know, why are you doing this? And she knows, you know, the people around you are a good gauge, and sometimes it just takes standing back and listening and really looking at your situation.
Yeah, there's a great satire that I've seen recently that I'm sure most of you have seen. I think some guys from Digital Domain put it together.
The
guy's sweating and the Red Bulls, and the wife sends the email like the kids miss you, and the closing is capital WTF, and we know what that is.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's, you know, what our life is, and there's a...
I'll put a link to that video. I think it's still on YouTube. I'll put a link to it in the story.
Yeah, this is great. And I read this quote, you know, like this whole Michelangelo thing comes up a lot because, you know, there was a letter he wrote to his dad. It's in CG Talk in one of my posts where he talks about, you know, how miserable it is. Perhaps I should just read it.
Like, if you have it, sure.
Yeah,
that'd be
let me
great.
Pull it up. Hold on.
Sure.
It just caught me. You know, I'd read that book when you know, I was in taking humanities, and I was wondering, why is the professor having us read all these stupid books?
Like,
oh, because later in life, you know, they really come into play in your life. In a letter to his father, who had written from Florence asking for money, Michelangelo wrote, quote, I lead a miserable existence. I live wearied by stupendous labors and beset by 1,000 anxieties. And thus have I lived for some 15 years as an artist, and never an hour's happiness have I had.
Wow. Well, I think that's a good place to end.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you best of luck, and I hope that you know, we can do something to help.
Well, thank you very much. Really enjoyed this, and looking forward to hearing it. Hopefully, you know, we get some more feedback, and, you know, all of us start to communicate a lot more with each other and our feelings, and try to build this, you know, this workforce into something even better than what it is now, if you can imagine that.
Well, I think that was really fascinating. I think one of the kind of maybe embarrassing things or interesting things about it was his background being outside the business and his kind of comments on how this business is run. It's like amateurish.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I'm all for too much business and too many MBAs ruling the NAST, of course, but I think there's a certain truth to that. The industry is just kind of fucked up in a lot of ways.
Well, it's true. And you know, the problem is when you start talking art, things become undefined. And it's, you know, his metaphor about some of the construction experience he has is very accurate. You know, we are asked to bid to build houses that we don't even have plans for and be held to that. And it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. The other thing is I think you guys pointed out and talked about, where the role that visual effects play in films nowadays. I mean, it's such a critical role. I mean, it's a supporting actor role. You know, it's on that level. It's not, you know, a cast.
Oh, absolutely.
It's supporting, you know, it's like, you know, the invisible effects in Batman, you know, this movie that we talked about. I mean, as artists, collective as a group, we should really have some power in the kind of stuff that we contribute to films like that.
Right, absolutely. We cross all disciplines in the movie making process as our characters go through wardrobe and lighting and sets and digital extensions and digital sets and digital actors. And it's truly, our impact is huge. And, you know, the costs are great and the risks are huge for the studios. We understand that. But, you know, I mean, look at Batman. The Dark Knight, what, $155 million the first weekend, $75 million the second weekend, and then a movie like Meet Dave, which did like $5 million the first weekend.
Yeah.
You know, obviously different scale movies, but still, a lot of visual effects work was put into, a lot more than that was probably put into the Meet Dave's visual effects. It's a big gamble, but the point is really, how do we become better participants in this process to deliver this work?
Make sure that we're compensated and treated fairly, you know? I don't think the studio execs are going home without a paycheck.
No, absolutely. And, you know, it's difficult to sometimes have this conversation when you read the articles. There was a series in the LA Times not too long ago about car wash employees, you know, making minimum wage and still getting screwed out of wages and stuff like that. And, yeah, we make a good living. And actually, the next podcast that we'll do on this subject with the Animation Guild, he makes some really good points about this and how people should be compensated and how the business has evolved. So, I mean, I think we're kind of getting, this is a specific example we just listened to, but I think it's raising a bunch of bigger issues. And I think that hopefully the next couple podcasts will help add to that discussion. So I hope people are liking this series. Let us know in the forums. It's kind of a different direction for us. You know, it's just a little departure here from directly talking about a film, but I think it's important we keep after this kind of information.
I certainly do. And thanks for following that, Jeff, because I know especially being out there in LA, you're very close to that stuff and know a lot of people, so appreciate you keeping track of it. I think it's fascinating and certainly needs to be at least talked about so that you at least get that discussion going, get it out in the open, and also not have artists afraid to be critical of things like that, because that's a concern as well.
You know, absolutely.
Like they'll seek retribution for some comments they might make. So,
yeah, absolutely. And you should definitely, the next podcast, we'll talk a lot more about that.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks for that. Got the big shoot tomorrow going on here in Chicago, doing a shoot for the new After Effects Master's course at FX PhD, which will be a lot of fun. Green screen stage shoot over at Resolution Digital Studios. Should be fun. Mark Collarin's doing graphics for that. Mark Christensen doing compositing, so it's a blast. It's a good term over to PhD, I think.
Yeah, what I've been seeing, I have been really busy on a job, and I haven't had time to keep up with my classes, but the ones I have watched, I've been, as always, impressed with and happy with, and anxious to dive into them when this job wraps up. And I'm anxious for SIGGRAPH. I'm going to get to hang with you guys. I know Mike's coming over before SIGGRAPH, and I was supposed to make that part of the trip. I didn't make that, but SIGGRAPH is coming up very soon, and I'm very excited about all the stuff we've got planned for that.
Yeah, I'm interested in both attending, and also, also may notice we've got a new FX Guide TV episode up on the site, and we just took a bit of hiatus. We had kind of other priorities that we need to take care of. We weren't going to drop it forever. We know everyone loves it, but got one up now, one coming out, a SIGGRAPH preview edition coming out in the coming weeks before SIGGRAPH, and then from SIGGRAPH we're going to be doing several releases from there with interviews and so forth from the show. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It'll just be fun hanging with you guys in LA.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Well, that's it. Again, as Jeff said, if you have any comments or questions, drop by the forums, drop us a line at podcasts@fxguide.com. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.